The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, South Jersey and Philadelphia. Inside Medicine is back on the tracks. I have to say this, that we have one of my favorite guests, Dr. Mark Fisher, who is a rheumatologist suprema. He has his own infusion center and is a superb communicator. Rheumatologists should all be like Mark. Mark basically has his degree from an association with Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital in South Jersey. He's in the Division of Rheumatology. He has his office at 713 Station Avenue, Haddon Heights, New Jersey, with his infusion center. He's a specialist on RA, osteoporosis disorders, psoriatic arthritis, and lupus. That's a guy who's got a lot of topics under his belly and or belt. And Mark, I'm welcoming you back to Inside Medicine again. Thank you for hopping on.
Thank you so much, Joe. It's always a pleasure to be here once again with you so we can speak to your audience and educate them on different medical issues. It's really my pleasure.
And you do a great job. That's all I can say, A++. So let me start off. Should a patient know that there is a need to see a rheumatologist like yourself?
Well, Jared, that's a really very, very important question because everyone associates rheumatology with only arthritis, but it really does go into very varied areas in medicine and in healthcare, and in particular, rheumatological related diseases, which can have an overlap with other entities as well in the medical field. So what I usually tell patients, if they have ongoing symptoms such as muscle aches, joint pain, if they have unexplained fevers or skin rashes, unusual chronic ongoing fatigue, which is not explainable on any other basis. So if they have these kinds of symptoms or just not feeling well, they are already will, of course, seek care and evaluation from their primary care physician, as it always should be. And then if there's no good explanation, things are not going any further for signs of improvement and getting back to what they feel may be their normal state of health and well-being, then they should seek a caretaker such as rheumatology, where they do deal with these different, what I call multi-system diseases. Things are not always explainable, and they be perhaps encompassed in some of these different rheumatological disorders in the arthritis family, in the connective tissue disorder family, to try to investigate further and see if we can come up with a better diagnosis and then offer a good program of management to help improve the patient. And that's where the rheumatology subspecialist in medicine comes into play.
So Mark, so rheumatology is a nice long name. And I think what you've been intimating is that rheumatologists take care of complex issues. Let me just ask you this. What are the usual items that you diagnose and treat expertly for patients in the audience listening in? What does a rheumatologist like yourself treat? What are the diagnoses so that people can make sure that they write it down?
I'm very glad you asked me that question. It's really very important for people to become a little bit more familiar with these things. These are unusual issues. And while we can read about these in different magazines and different podcasts, and we can Google all kinds of things, and that's good for people to do, as long as they get information, I would say, from more reliable sources, not the chat room, and certainly not on other social media. They can sometimes be informative, but oftentimes very misleading. So the kinds of disorders, Joe, that I tend to see most often are various kinds of arthritis disorders. Now, these can be anywhere from ongoing wear and tear with age, such as a condition we call osteoarthritis. And this can affect either one or two or even multiple joints, the spine, especially the neck area, and the lower back area, hips, knees, ankles, feet, hands, shoulders, neck, you name it. It can be anywhere in the body. And this gives patients ongoing stiffness and pain, and it can persist, but it can be managed and they can be helped. Then we go into another variety of arthritis, Joe, what we call the systemic inflammatory arthritides, systemic inflammatory arthritis. Now, this is a much more aggressive arthritis. It tends to affect people at much younger ages. So we can see patients eat at childhood. We can see them as teenagers, their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, all the way into their 80s and 90s. What's more peculiar about this kind of systemic inflammatory arthritis, of which the main one is something called rheumatoid arthritis, and also another condition associated with skin rashes known as psoriatic arthritis. And then we have another group very similar to this whole systemic inflammatory arthritis called the spondyloarthropathies. Now, that's a big, big, big word, but it all comes down to if people might have seen such things as ankylosing spondylitis. And often, too often times, misdiagnosis in the young individual, because it does occur in younger people in their teens, childhood perhaps, and their 20s and 30s. So when people have ongoing, unexplainable neck and back pain in particular, and that may even affect other joints such as the hip, the knees, the shoulders, the hands, they should really seek more specialized care with rheumatology, because they be having this inflammatory arthritic condition that affects primarily in the spine, but it can involve other joints, much like its cousin rheumatoid can. These groups of inflammatory systemic arthritis disorders are extremely, extremely treatable these days, Joe. And there's no reason 95 to 99% of the time that people should go untreated and have this severe disabling arthritis damage that can occur from these very aggressive systemic arthritis disorders when there's such good effective treatment. Now, I never promise anyone, Joe, I'm going to cure them. But what we try to do our best at is try to get this condition under really, really good control. And the most important thing, there's two parts to the treatment here, Joe. One is the obvious, that is, let's reduce the pain. Let's make somebody comfortable. But the other very, very important part is to offer them treatments that will impact the immune system so that we can absolutely arrest this joint damage that can occur, the disabling condition that this could result in for these kinds of patients. But we have other disorders as well, Joe, aside from the arthritis problems, and that's a condition called gout. And that's due to...
Mark, can I ask you 1 second to hold on? Because I just want to, Mark, can I ask you one thing? So the question is that Joe, in your bag of treatments, are there things that you can do that can reverse or make sure that this rheumatoid condition doesn't go any further? So it is important to see somebody who's got the capacity to understand and apply these super drugs to the patient. Is there a difference between you treating something like this and, say, a family doctor? Because it looks to me like you have a specialty in pharmacologic intervention that really can help cure and make sure that nothing gets worse.
Absolutely. That's what I'm trying to allude to, Joe. Now, your primary care physician can do a great job in getting things started. That is, try to assess the patient based on the symptoms, perhaps do some blood work, perhaps some x-rays to try to further diagnostically assess what is causing this patient's arthritis complaints. But the primary care physician, Joe, doesn't have perhaps the experience or training and background and using these other more sophisticated, more potentially risky and toxic medicines, but also these medicines, the risk is small to the patient, but most importantly, they can do a dramatic, dramatic job in trying to reduce the inflammation and, very importantly, reduce the risk of damage. Now, I always tell patients, I'm not curing you and I cannot reverse. We can't go backwards in time to undo damage that has occurred. However, that's never, never, ever a reason not to proceed and try to protect the patient from this day going forward. Yesterday is gone, but today and tomorrow is here, and we can do so much to help protect that patient. The more sophisticated type treatments we do have available now, from all the different research that has been done and development by the pharmaceutical industry and the use of these by trained physicians are drugs that help to impact the immune system, because these drugs impact the autoimmune process that is causing untold inflammation in the body, affecting the joints, and most importantly, unfortunately, can affect other internal organs as well, such as the heart, the lungs, the kidneys, the nervous system. And these drugs, what they do, Joe, is they try to interrupt this ongoing cascade of severe inflammation, which when it gets into different body parts, especially the joints, it can cause gradual eroding of the cartilage. It can cause erosions in the bone. And then you have instability of these joints. This now leads to deforming of the joint and lack of good functionality. These persons can become very disabled, dysfunctional, walking, feeding themselves can all be impaired. But even though this sounds scary, and it is scary, the point being, by interrupting this whole immune system with these drugs, we call these disease-modifying drugs, and a new group of these disease-modifying drugs are called these biologicals, these what we call monoclonal antibodies, because they are antibodies directed against a specific inflammatory substance in our body, which is causing this intense, severe, ongoing inflammation and eventual damage to the body in these different areas, the joints, heart, kidneys, nervous system, lungs. So by instituting these different drugs, we have methotrexate, which has been used for many, many years for cancer treatment, a little bit today, but fortunately for all of us, oncologists have even more effective drugs to treat cancer patients. Another drug called leflunomide, very similar to methotrexate, but affects a different part of the immune system. These drugs have been for many years, I've been using these drugs for 30, 40 years, and they can have a good impact on reducing inflammation and reducing the joint damage, the erosions that caused in the past patients who need joint replacements. The orthopedic doctors don't like me much anymore because they're not getting as many of my patients as they did 30 years ago because I'm able to save the joints by using these drugs. But what we're finding, Joe, is that only a third of patients get the significant improvement that we want and the patient wants. As a result, we now have, over the past 25 years, the occurrence, the release of various drugs we call the biological drugs. And these drugs are all given by injection. There are a whole new group of drugs now even given orally. And these drugs act on a specific part of the immune system in trying to reduce the inflammation. And also they've been demonstrated very, very nicely in all the different studies that have been done before they were even released to be used publicly. They've been found to be extremely helpful, useful, and effective in reducing not just pain and stiffness and active swelling of these joints, but also the damage in the joints and the systemic effects of these arthritic conditions in patients, giving them a marked improvement in their quality of life and keeping them functional, keeping them working, keeping their psychological status much better, keeping their sociological and family life much better because they can function now. They're not suffering in pain the way they did. They're not having a lack of function. They're not going to the orthopedic doctor to replace these damaged joints anymore.
So, Mark, can I just give a summary for 1 second? So you're saying a rheumatologist makes sure that they protect the patient's cartilage, make sure that they protect their bone, and make sure that their joint stability sticks around so they don't need other surgical interventions, et cetera. Would you say that's a good summary of what your job is, what you have to protect in that each individual patient?
Yes, absolutely, Joe. But there's another piece of which I didn't allude to yet, which I want to complete my response to that question. That's a really critical question. So the answer is absolutely yes. There's so much we can do. But the other part I want to make your audience understand is this. Not only is it a matter of your aches and pains, your damaged joints or deforming joints and need for surgery sometimes to help recover these joints so you can be more functional, but there's systemic effects of these conditions on patients. And that is really a critical thing physicians and patients alike must appreciate. And that is these patients with chronic systemic inflammatory disease are increased risk for cancers, increased risk for cardiovascular disease, such as heart attack and stroke. And the presence of systemic inflammation is just as key a risk factor for cardiovascular problems as diabetes, as high cholesterol, as smoking, as family history, and all these other known risk factors, which most of us are familiar with. You know, there's a calculator that many physicians, primary care, cardiologists, and others may use to try to assess what is the risk of this person developing a heart attack and a stroke over the next 10 years. And you can get that risk calculation putting in their family history, their diabetes or cholesterol, all these different issues. But whatever that risk factor is, Joe, and it might be a normal risk. However, if they also have lupus or they have rheumatoid arthritis, now that risk goes up by 50%. 50% increase in risk. Now they're, instead of being normal risk, they may actually now be high risk. That's why it's so critically important that we control this systemic inflammation.
Well, I'm glad you're there. That's all I can say, Mark. And I love your synopsis. Beautiful. So what is autoimmunity?
Well, that's a wonderful question, Joe. And that's something which I think a lot of people don't have a good understanding, and many of us don't. So what we know is that our bodies tolerate themselves because we have what we call tolerance. We recognize what is ours as ours. And therefore, our immune system, which is there to protect us, leaves it alone. Now, let's say someone needs a skin graft or a liver transplant, a heart transplant. What happens then is our bodies recognize that that is foreign, or if a bacteria or a virus enters our system, our immune system there again wants to protect us. So it recognizes these different organs or these different germs, shall I say, as foreign, and it tries to attack it to protect us, which is the host. And that's well and good, and that's how it should be. But what happens is physicians that deal with organ transplantation, for example, they will give drugs to impair the immune system to help that patient accept that organ transplant and not reject it so it can function and give better life to that individual. Now, sometimes it's usually on genetic basis. Some individuals might develop what we call autoimmunity, and that is now their body is not having the same tolerance and accepting all their tissues as being self, as being normal. Now it's recognized it as being foreign and forms antibodies against some of these tissues in our body. It may be against certain parts of our DNA system, for example. So that's a problem because now we have, because of this intense inflammation and forming antibodies against our cells, we now develop this severe, intense inflammation, which then causes, as I alluded to previously, damage, whether it's a joint or the skin, the heart, kidneys, lungs, wherever these antibodies may be directed. And we have to recognize that we talk about autoimmunity.
So, Mark, does that
mean rheumatology? Yes.
Mark, can I bother you for 1 second?
Absolutely.
Okay,
never bother, Joe.
So, again, okay. So, you're talking about these antibodies. So, that means that the person's own immune system is making a mistake, and instead of turning on something that shouldn't be there is actually attacking good stuff that's there. So your job there is to protect the good stuff by countering these antibodies. Is that correct?
That is absolutely right, Joe. And we have to recognize that when I talk about autoimmunity, it's not just a single disease. And we have to recognize that this goes all throughout all general medicine. What I'd like to point out to your listeners as well is that when we deal with rheumatology, we have a whole slew of different disorders that we may label as autoimmune disorders. There's rheumatoid arthritis, there's lupus, there's psoriatic arthritis, polymyositis, which affects the muscles, Sjögren syndrome, which can give people severe dryness of the mouth, the skin, the eyes, and even cause inflammation in the lungs. But we have to recognize, Joe, that all different areas of specialization in medicine also have autoimmune conditions. In your area, in diabetes, there's type 1 diabetes that could be at play here as well. There's Graves' disease, Hashimoto's, all have an autoimmune basis. And there's neurology, myasthenia gravis. There's multiple sclerosis, GI with Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, celiac disease. There's a whole slew of different areas in medicine where we can be confronted with autoimmunity. And that's why we may have to take an immune basis to try and treat these conditions. And also then we have to replace those things that are being impaired by this autoimmunity, for example, insulin, diabetes, or B12 and pernicious anemia in hematology, and other immune-related drugs in neurology with multiple sclerosis or myasthenia gravis. So we have to address all these things, including, of course, rheumatological diseases, such as all the things I've alluded to. And what has made a big difference in this century compared to other centuries is we have these biological agents, which I was talking about previously, and they've made a gigantic difference in the well-being of patients in controlling these autoimmune-related disorders and having patients try to maintain as normal a functional existence with the least amount of disease activity as possible.
I'll say amen to that, Mark. That's all I can say. So you want to move on a second? And there's this great, great diagnosis called lupus, because that's one thing I'm sure that you deal with as a rheumatologist, and that's where other docs would love to have you take part in helping their patients out. So what about lupus?
Thank you for asking that, Joe. Lupus is, again, one of these diseases which can be a little covert, and it may kind of sneak up on patients because some of the symptoms are not necessarily always immediately recognizable. So it's important, like I said in the very beginning of the first question you asked me, patients have to realize if they're not feeling well, they have to continue to investigate, and if they're not finding the answer with their primary care, then seek other care such as rheumatology. So the symptoms that we see here, it affects women much, much, much more commonly than in men. And this can affect young women, their teens and 20s. And it can have a lot of different diseases. And what it is, it's not getting a strep throat. You have a sore throat, you get a culture, we find strep, we treat the antibiotic. End of story. But with lupus, it's what we call a syndrome. It's really finding the complex of different symptoms, different abnormal physical findings, and a variety of different laboratory findings, which together we have to make that diagnosis. So it's not just one thing which makes the diagnosis. It's this collective group of different symptoms, physical findings, and laboratory studies. So the most common symptoms we find is severe chronic fatigue state. Fatigue is probably the most common sign and symptom of any chronic inflammatory condition. Many things can cause fatigue. It's not specific for lupus, not specific for rheumatoid arthritis, not even specific only for anemia. But it can be a sign that there's some chronic ailment and we have to try to explain it. So fatigue is common. We see skin rashes can occur anywhere. The most classic one is what we call a malar rash. That is a rash that's over the front of the cheeks and the bridge of the nose. But it can affect the whole face and it can affect any part of the body. And what's very particular about a lupus rash is that when people have sun exposure, now, I tell patients all the time, so I'm not out in the sun, doc. They said, well, you were in the sun. You came to my office, you were in the sun this morning. So we have to remember, it's not just going to the pool, not just going to the beach, but going to the mail, taking your walk, going out in the car shopping. You're still in the sun. So these rashes with lupus patients are very sensitive to the sun, and they can get much, much worse with sun exposure. Patients can get little ulcerations or sores in their nose or inside their mouth under the gums, under the tongue, or on the tongue itself. We call that stomatitis, inflammation in these mucous membrane areas. That can also be a very common ailment in lupus patients. They can have arthritis symptoms. They can have myalgias, which means pain and stiffness in the muscles, pain and stiffness in the joints, and also swelling of the joints. And very frequently, Joe, the arthritis in a lupus patient occurs symmetrically in both sides of the body, both hands, the knuckles in both hands, the wrist joints, the knees, the ankles. So that's very, just like rheumatoid arthritis, it can be a very symmetrical appearing arthritis, but a little bit different from rheumatoid in that it's very, very unusual for this to be a damaging, deforming arthritis like the rheumatoid patient that's untreated can have. So So there's where we are here. Now we have other kinds of systemic symptoms, such as chest pain, because patients may develop what we call pericarditis, which is inflammation around the heart, or pleurisy, or pleuritis, which means inflammation around the lungs. So what happens there, someone might have a pressure or severe pain with deep breathing, because these linings move with deep breathing and moving about, and that can cause increased pain. So just touching the chest is not what this would be. That would be just inflammation in the cartilage, in the ribs themselves. But this occurs is a deeper pain around these organs, the lung and the heart. The patient can also have with exposure to what we call Raynaud's phenomenon. And that is with cold exposure, the fingers may get very pale and then get very red. And that's due not to a blockage in the circulation, Joe, but due to a spasm in the arteries. And if untreated, if it gets severe, that can cause ulcerations and even loss of their digits. But fortunately, this can be usually very well controlled in most patients. I mentioned the photosensitivity, where their arthritis, their skin rash can become worse with sun exposure. Then what we have is we find the physical findings of the rash, the tender joints, tender muscles, swelling of the joints. We might hear abnormal sounds when we listen to the lungs and the heart when the physician examines the patient. And we call that a rub, which is due to this irritation that the lining of the heart or the lining of the lungs may have. And we can hear that when we listen to the patient's heart and lungs. And then, of course, we have the laboratory assessment, which is very key in assessing further patients with having systemic lupus. And we take all this together. And screening test called the ANA, anti-nuclear antibody, is actually a group of different antibodies, but this is the most sensitive test, which is an indicator that some autoimmune condition is present. It's not specific for lupus, Joe, it can occur in rheumatoid arthritis, polymyositis, Sjögren's syndrome, scleroderma, many different autoimmune-related disorders. But then we have other more specific antibody tests to try to assess this patient and diagnose their systemic lupus. We have the anti-double-stranded DNA. We have other related autoantibodies as well. We have complement levels, which are, again, proteins in the blood, which are very active in this whole inflammatory process. And what's very important to understand is that this whole relationship of this autoimmunity with all these different things, the antibody, the protein is directed against, these complements form what we call an immune complex, and they can get trapped in our tissues, cause the rash, arthritis, and they get trapped in the kidney, and that can cause severe nephritis and kidney failure. So all these different things we can do in assessment, but it's key to remember it's a whole complex here between our history of what the patient has noticed and complains about, the physical findings, and the laboratory. We put these all together, and that's how we come with the diagnosis, and that's when we can embark on have a treatment plan for these patients. Now, back when I was a medical resident some 40 years ago, we knew at that time there was a 30% mortality, 30% mortality in patients with lupus over 5 years. So in 5 years, almost a third of patients can expect to die. Now, we can say we have at least a 99% plus over the next 10 years of survival. And patients can do so, so much better. Because, again, as I've alluded to earlier in our conversation today, Joe, we have these medicines which can impact the immune system. They can get this severe, intense inflammation, this severe, intense autoantibody attack on our own bodies under control, and we can save them from their kidney failure, their heart disease, lung disease, arthritis, the rashes, the neurological impairment that can occur. But it takes a toll because we have to get into
Mark, can I ask you a question?
Related medications. Certainly, Joe.
So, Mark, let me just ask you a question. So it's coming to the end of the year, and people have to decide what kind of insurance they're going to buy. So the issue here is we're talking about this phenomenal 30% mortality. Now you're a 1% mortality. The question is, how much does it cost to get these antibodies that will counter these nasty antibodies? And as a rheumatologist, is there any recommendation you can make if a patient has a rheumatoid condition such as these that can be disabling and even take a life? at the end of the year? Is there any special something that they could purchase, you know, before the year closes off to make sure that they have the proper insurance to cover these antibodies and rheumatoid, you know, phenomenal drugs? Tough question, but just asking because it just seems like when you can go from a 30% mortality down to 1%, it's going to cost money. Can you just help me out here?
That's an extremely important, extremely relevant question, Joe. I'm so glad you brought that up. Now, let me, first of all, my disclaimer is I'm not an insurance broker, but I do have a good familiarity with all this because I deal with this with patients every single day of the week. So in the non-Medicare patient, of course, they may have insurance that they purchase on their own, or probably more commonly than that, they get it through work. So these drugs are very expensive, as you asked in the first part of your question. And I would say these drugs can cost $2,000 to $3,000 a month, give or take, which is still extremely expensive, extremely costly, and very effective in trying to control these diseases. So when someone has commercial insurance, hopefully and frequently, their insurance carrier should cover these medicines. Now, if they don't cover them 100%, they may have 50%, 70, 80% perhaps, which still leaves a lot of money left over for the patient to have out of pocket. Fortunately, in many cases, the pharmaceutical companies do offer what we call co-payment assistance, and they will often supplement their basic medical insurance by taking care of the rest of the bill, not for the infusion procedure, but for the drug itself that they are that we are providing. So that's helpful. Unfortunately, for the last 25 years or so, we've had federal law where they are not permitted, which is incredible to comprehend, they're not permitted to offer the same copay assistance for a patient that's on Medicare. Makes no sense to the most vulnerable group in our country who have probably the most limited financial means. They're not allowed to get this financial assistance. So we have to understand the difference now between Part D. Part D is in David Medicare, the prescription plan. And anything which is self-administered, such as insulin injection, such as other injections I might give someone that they inject themselves subcutaneously, these are all considered prescriptions being self-administered by the patient, and therefore it's under Part D, and therefore they are now open to this whole big gap with coverage from Medicare, which means they may have to spend thousands of dollars. Fortunately, with the legislation that the current administration has passed, that should go down to $2,000 maximum out of pocket starting next year. But still, it's an awful lot of money for someone to come up with. Now, the other part we can do is under Part B, as in boy, Part B Medicare, this is something physician administers, such as an intravenous infusion or certain drugs which a physician has to mix together and administer subcutaneously. Now, being that it's a physician administer, it's considered a medical treatment, not a prescription, and therefore is covered under your regular Medicare coverage, just as your office is or hospitalization would be. That makes it much more affordable for most patients on Medicare. So when we come down to what kind of coverage does someone have? Well, we know there's a lot of big push in advertising and all the major commercial carriers, whether Aetna, MeriHealth, Horizon, Cigna, you name it. They're all trying to push what they call Medicare Advantage programs, or what we call Medicare C. Now, this has an advantage in that the premiums are lower. They have higher copays, but the overall premium is lower. They are combined all with one plan, both your medical, your hospitalization, your prescription plan, your laboratory, actually all combined into one. So it seems on the surface, at least, to be cheaper. But what people have to realize with higher copays, you have to make sure that how many doctors you see, how much healthcare you need, will really determine if it truly is a medical savings. Because what happens here, Joe, is that a lot of these commercial carriers in the Medicare Advantage type programs, there could be some programs which cover you 100%, but when someone, an insurance agent tells a prospective subscriber here, oh, you're covered. So in my mind, at least, when someone tells me I'm covered, I think I'm 100% covered. That's what it seems to me to be the logical conclusion from that statement. And that is the farthest thing from the truth. when they say you're covered, the insurance means as long as they cover you by $1, it's true, you're covered, but then you got to pay the other $3,000 yourself. So every patient should always inquire of the insurance company or the broker they're dealing with. When you say I'm covered for this drug the doctor has recommended for me, how much am I covered? What is my out-of-pocket exposure here? So if they say 100%, then fine, then that's a good program for you. But what I have found is that patients just need some doctor visits, a handful of doctor visits a year. They're in pretty good health. Probably these programs are cost savings for them, no question. But if someone has more sophisticated health care needs, unfortunately, these drugs are costly and their out-of-pocket expense could be so high they will not be able to afford to get these treatments. And like I said, by law, the federal government will not allow the pharmaceutical companies to financially assist this group of patients on Medicare who need the care and the financial assistance the most. So patients have to be very careful in looking at that. And if they do have costly care, whether it's rheumatology, cardiology, diabetes care, whatever the case may be, they have to then consider whether they should stay with traditional Medicare. And then that means they need to have what they call Medigap B coverage as a supplement. And the third, they'll need Medicare Part D, which covers for prescriptions. And the website for Medicare.gov is very, very helpful in putting all your medicines here and give the patient a good idea of whether it's a more affordable mode of doing it versus the Medicare Advantage program. So you have to add up the numbers. So what is my health care cost between my premiums, my deductibles, my co-payments, and all my out-of-pocket costs versus doing it individually of Medicare traditional plus the Medigap B plus the Medicare D, which is prescription coverage. Patients have to see what is affordable and what do I need to be healthy and to live, and then you have to make those decisions on that basis. A little complicated,
Mark, that was
Joe,
fantastic.
It's what it is.
Mark, fantastic explanation. I love it. I'm glad you're here. I just want to move on from dollars and cents now to a disease process called vasculitis, because rheumatologists are the king of the hill, in my impression here, with vasculitis. Maybe the cardiologists want to hop in too. But can you enlighten us about vasculitis from a rheumatoid perspective?
I'd be happy to, Joe. Now, vasculitis is, shall I say, a very general and generic term, and it literally refers to inflammation of blood vessels. Now, we can see this in so many disorders I already alluded to today, in more severe cases of lupus and rheumatoid arthritis, where it can involve the blood vessels getting inflamed. And these blood vessels get inflamed, if it's in the skin, it can cause severe skin ulcerations and rashes and infections. If it occurs in the heart, it can lead to a heart attack. If it's in other large blood vessels, it can lead to damage in these vessels, which can cause a lack of blood flow to the different organs. If it's in the head, it can induce strokes. So different parts of our body can be involved with this type of inflammation. So what's very important to understand with vasculitis, as I teach the residents when I see them, is that we kind of divide vasculitis, or this inflammation of blood vessels, into three main groups. That is, those that affect large vessels, and a prime example of that is something called temporal arteritis or giant cell arteritis, where the large blood vessels, such as the aorta or the large and medium vessels, go into the brain. That's why it can cause stroke, loss of vision, if untreated from this inflammation. Then we have the very small vessels that involve more like the skin, and we get skin rashes with it, which can be generalized all over the body. And third, we have what we call the medium-sized vessels. And that is it, the arteries going to the kidneys, the arteries going to the GI tract, and even the brain itself. And these are the most problematic ones. So the large vessel ones, like giant cell arteritis, the small vessel, a name we give leukocytoclastic vasculitis, we don't have to remember the name, of course, but those areas, those two are most responsive to the administration of steroids or cortisone medicine. They respond beautifully, so therefore they can be well controlled and the risk of severe damage and consequences is very small, other than the risk of steroids themselves, which we can talk to if we have time. So that's the good part on the patient's end, because they can feel more reassured that they can do very well. Now, the conditions which involve the medium-sized arteries are much more problematic and much more threatening to the health and welfare of the patient. Condition that we call ANCA-associated vasculitis. ANCA refers to certain antibodies we see with these kinds of inflammatory vasculitis disorders, and such diseases as polyarteritis. And these kind of diseases can cause severe damage. Sometimes the presenting symptoms here could be rashes. It could be simply numbness and tingling in the hands and feet because they damage the nerves. Sometimes we can have abdominal pain associated with these conditions. We get inflammation in the lungs or even just asthma associated with some of these other problems I'm alluding to as well. These kinds of vasculitis conditions, which can cause severe, intense, aggressive damage in heart, lungs, skin, and kidneys, and even the sinuses, these conditions require these biological agents to try and get them under control. Otherwise, these patients can really fail to survive. They can have kidney failure, respiratory failure, heart failure. It can cause serious, serious damage to their current health and to their prognosis and well-being. But the important point is, Joe, we do have drugs which can control these diseases. Not nearly as well as with the large vessel like Giant's arteritis or the small vessel like the skin-related vasculitis. But these can do a great job in trying to control some of these diseases. Like Rituxan is one of these biologic agents that we use. And there's some other newer agents that are being used as well to control these inflammatory systemic disorders because they can affect so many different parts of our bodies. But again, we have to recognize it. Again, with unexplained fevers, skin rashes, respiratory ailments, sudden change in kidney function, abdominal pain, all these things together are more likely than not to go into the realm of this vasculitis. And the case of giant cell arteritis that we have spoken to in previous sessions, this is oftentimes associated with another systemic condition we call polymyalgia rheumatica. This usually affects people over the age of 60 or 65, and it can cause severe, intense, prolonged stiffness in the morning, which can last for hours, actually, severe pain in the muscles. Patients feel, I'm weak, but actually they're not weak, Joe. They just can't lift their arms and their legs because it hurts so much. The pain is so exquisite. There's severe stiffness. They feel weak, but it's really the pain, fatigue they have. And what is unfortunate, 40% of these patients may have associated with this condition giant cell arteritis or what we call temporal arteritis. And that is much more aggressive of inflammation. And what's important about it, one of the signs of this besides the polymyalgia symptoms that I just alluded to, patient can have severe unremitting headache on one side of the head or even both sides, and they have severe pain in the jaw when speaking or chewing. And what is the consequence of this inflammation? Can have sudden loss of vision in the eye, even just one eye. Even if it comes back after seconds, that's a very, very dangerous sign that they have involvement of the arteries to the optic nerve, and they can have permanent loss of vision, which is preventable. We have to, again, as I've alluded to with all these rheumatic type diseases and medicine in general, we must recognize these disorders early. Once we can define that this person is polymyalgia rheumatica or have these signs with headache, jaw pain, and plus possible visual changes, we immediately get that person on high doses of steroid to try to combat this disease. But even when we treat these people with steroids, that can do very, very well in trying to control it and reduce the risk of some of these different conditions that can occur, such as blindness or stroke. But we have to remember, unfortunately, sometimes they can still flare up later on. So we use, in these patients as well, Joe, we use one of these biological agents, one called Actemra, which we also use to treat rheumatoid arthritis, for example. And these infusions or subcutaneous injections of Actemra can do a great job in, one, lowering the dependency on steroids, so it lowers the risk of the side effects from this drug, which is so helpful and also can be so hurtful because of its side effects. So this Actemra, which is a biological, what we call monoclonal antibody, it fights a certain inflammatory substance we call interleukin-6. And that is what's most active with inflammation, rheumatoid arthritis, but also in this giant cell arteritis condition. that can go a long way to minimize use
of steroids. Mark, can I ask you a question?
Protecting the patient from ongoing inflammation. Sure, Joe. Absolutely.
Okay. So, Mark, it's Saturday. Mark Fisher is doing his homework, whatever, to make sure that his charts are fixed up. Gets a phone call that the patient that he's taken care of for 5 years all of a sudden had loss of vision temporarily in her right eye. So what does that make you do on a Saturday when you're trying to clean up the paperwork? What do you have to advise that patient?
I advise the patient that time is of the essence, and that means not tonight, not tomorrow, not Monday morning, but immediately hop in the car, you get over to the emergency department of your nearest hospital and have them call me. And also, you tell them you have your name, your condition, you have giant cell arteritis, and your doctor said you need high dose steroids. So in a case that you described, Joe, where there's already some sudden loss of vision, even if it came back to normal right now, that's a sign this person's in serious, serious trouble. And immediately I will give them extremely high doses of steroids, a drug we call solumedrol or methylprednisolone. I would probably give them 1,000 milligrams per day over 3 days intravenously. And then I will finish my treatment, then giving them 80 milligrams of prednisone, which is a steroid complement, orally for a period of time, and then gradually taper as I see they're okay. And at the same time, when I see them in the office, I would then start them on these Actemra infusions that I was alluding to a few minutes ago. But the prime issue here is immediacy. This is an emergency. This is one of the few medical emergencies in rheumatology. You immediately get the emergency department, immediately got to get this intravenous administered steroid and have a sed rate, a C-reactive protein, which are two tests, which test inflammation, but there's no time to wait. When this symptoms occur and a patient already diagnosed with giant cell arteritis, immediacy is the key to being treated successfully here.
So, Mark, the average person, I would say, makes about 7.5 milligrams of prednisone a day. Of course, we make hydrocortisone, but I'm giving you an equivalency. And so how does that compare, that 7.5 a day for the entire day, to what you're recommending the ER doc to quickly give intravenously? What's that ratio, or what's your impression for the how much you really need to make sure that you save that vision?
Okay, well, certainly when the patient has a disease state like this, like you said, we make about 7.5 milligrams of prednisone to the equivalency of hydrocortisone. And that would be what our bodies normally make. And of course, we're under stress, we might need more, of course. But I'm administering in a patient with a crisis like this, where they have a sudden onset of visual change in the history of a vasculitis condition like giant cell arteritis. I give them 1,000 milligrams every day for 3 days. And then I start them on not 7.5, which is their basic normal amount that their bodies will make for our subsidence. I give them 80 milligrams, 7.5 up to now 80. And that is why, unfortunately, we have to be so concerned with the risk of side effects and elevate the sugar in our diabetic patient, increase risk of cataracts, risk of infection, and stomach ulcers, fluid retention, osteoporosis, bone fractures, infections, all these things we have to be concerned with. We also must be concerned with treating the disease state and then taking whatever precautions we can to try to counteract the risk of the side effects of the steroids. But we must save the patient from becoming blind and from getting further arteritis or inflammation in the blood vessels causing a stroke or heart attack, or what we call dissection of the aorta, which means that the aorta becomes ripped inside from all this inflammation, and the blood begins to trickle down in this pocket it causes and not allowing it to get to the body where it's needed. And that can be a matter of death in hours. So that's why we must focus on, one, the successful acute management of this problem, and then at the same time begin to address how can we best reduce the risk of side effects from the drug. And a couple of things we would do is, one, we'd monitor their blood sugars, especially if they're diabetic, but if they're not diabetic, they could be pre-diabetic and not realize that they might have diabetes. Second, we give them medicine to reduce the acid in the stomach, so you try to prevent stomach ulcers. Thirdly, on a more longer-term basis, we treat them with medicine to reduce bone loss because these drugs can cause bone loss and risk of fractures in such patients. So we take all these other precautions the best that we can. And then at the same time, as I alluded to already, we say, what else can I do for this person to reduce the risk of these high-dose steroids that they need to control their illness? And that's why I do the infusions of the Actemra in that regard as well. But we must take particular attention because these steroid drugs are phenomenal. They've been with us since the 1950s, and they've done a world of good for patients and also, unfortunately, a world of bad. But we have to address the world of the bad and also make the good even better by having some other options, as I've been alluding to, with these other biologic agents and other protective ways to reduce the risk of stomach ulcers, sugars out of control, and bone fractures.
So, Mark, I got to ask you. So basically, we can see how you know organized your brain is and getting things done and making sure that your patients are winners. Can you just tell me on the flip side, what are some of the reasons that patients fail to follow through with the management that you would suggest? So what makes the patients fail not to show up or not to face the facts, or that they decide to go without intervention that you would recommend for their significant high-risk problems that these rheumatoid conditions are?
That's a critically important question, Jay. Thank you so much. And, there are two main things I would say to that. There's two words. One is called motivation, and the other is called human behavior. I guess that's really two words there. So the thing about this, Joe, is that when people are in crisis, they hurt, they can see a problem. They don't have too much difficulty in wanting to go along with the medical program that the physician has recommended. The problem we get into, however, is that you get a lot of misinformation, disinformation out there, unfortunately, in this political climate that we all are living in now. And people then get scared of taking their medicine because they're more afraid of the risk of side effects than controlling their current illness. So it's a matter of education from the physician and trying to break through that type of barrier and make sure the patient understands you're going to do all you can do to minimize the risk of adverse reactions. But no, you cannot give 100% guarantee. But most importantly, let's control this illness. And the other part with all this is that once a person is doing better, Joe, it's hard to take medicine when you feel fine. So people say, well, I don't need this anymore. But what they don't perhaps understand is that low-grade inflammation can still be ongoing in their body, even though, fortunately, it may not be enough inflammation to cause an actual problem right now. Patients with gout, it's typical for that. So that when patients have no gouty attack, they don't want to take their allopurinol to keep the uric acid low because they feel fine. Until they get an attack, then they realize how unfine they really were. And in that case, we have to make sure we control the uric acid at the proper level to reduce the risk of attacks. People with hypertension, classic. There again, their diabetes, classic again. They're feeling fine, so they may want to get off. Say, I'm tired of paying for these drugs. I'm tired of taking all these pills. But the problem is not the pills. The problem is control the illness, educate the patient, let them know it's there. Here are the risks of not being treated with this disease present versus the benefit and potential risk of the treatment by taking your proper treatment recommended by your physician. And I find frequently by having regular visits with the patient, by educating them in this way, it does become very helpful. But unfortunately, I would say, Joe, my experience has been that over the years, when the physician has less, the patient has less physician contact, that lesser frequency of contact, which sometimes is just a necessity of life, the way things are now, but the volume of patients that physicians have to undertake their care. But the less contact there is, the more likely they're going to fall off the wagon, so to speak, and their compliance may go down. So it's a matter of having a system where we do have better contact with patients and kind of giving a little booster shot of confidence and re-education so you stay with the program to maintain their health. We can have the greatest access to drugs, the greatest pharmacology of drugs in the world, but if the patient doesn't have access to it because of finances, or you don't maintain access because of lack of education and lack of motivation they had to control their illness, then doesn't matter how fancy our drugs are, how effective they are, how beneficial they are, the patient is not compliant with it. And we all do as physicians the best we can do to educate them, let them understand the risk of side effects, but also the benefit they get from these treatments. And I think we can be very successful in maintaining good health for our patients.
Mark, I gotta give you a break. Let me just tell people that Mark Fisher is a phenomenal, well-educated, and an impressive rheumatologist. He has a fax number of 856-547-8377. His website is www.markfishermd.com. He is a fellow of the American College of Rheumatology. As you can tell, he's incredibly well-versed. He is a graduate of Hahnemann Medical College, and I'm sure they're very happy to say that. And he is a graduate of the rheumatology education at Temple University Hospital. He's board certified in internal medicine, rheumatology, clinical densitometry. That means he can assist people with bone loss, osteoporosis, osteopenia. And he is associated with the Division of Rheumatology at Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital. Dr. Mark Fisher, as you can tell, is a fantastic physician. I give him an A-plus rating, plus, and I'm sure you do too. So again, Mark Fisher has a phone number of 856-547-8004. Mark, Inside Medicine, and I thank you very much for hopping on. His podcast will be up after the show, hopefully in 30 minutes. Thank you again, Mark. We'll see you guys next week on Inside Medicine.